It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the new WPR podcast, Mapped Out, tells us how Wisconsin's current electoral maps came to be and what they've meant for our politics. In this week's debut episode, Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden dig into the process of redistricting and gerrymandering. First, the U.S. House is scheduled to vote on a bipartisan infrastructure package tomorrow, a proposal that already passed the Senate with bipartisan support last month. But House Republicans are being encouraged to vote against it, and progressive Democrats are threatening to vote it down if there's no deal to pass President Biden's larger social safety net package. It's the week in Washington. We'll look at that and the threat of a government shutdown coming up in days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. After all this back and forth, are you hoping that something gets passed in Congress? Do you want to see increased spending for roads, bridges, broadband, that sort of thing? How about the other package with child tax credit payments, more funding related to climate change? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
There's a lot of complicated twists and turns, Ginger, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, what it comes down to is Democrats will either pass something or they won't, and it's really hard to predict which it's going to be at this point. Do I have that about right?
I think that's close. I mean, generally, bills either pass or they don't. So that's the fate of all of them. But I would say that even watching sort of all of this drama unfold in Washington, or sausage making, if we're going to pick another cliche, it's still very likely that Congress passes both of their top priority pieces of legislation on, in sort of the broader sense, the two you mentioned, the infrastructure bill and then the social safety net bill, and that they pass a bill this week to keep the government funded and avoid a shutdown on Friday. So it looks like everything is probably going to get done. There just might be some headaches for people before they get there.
Well, I want to focus in on one piece of the drama here and give a listen to Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, on MSNBC yesterday, talking about the differences between Democrats on the order in which to pass these two bills. Here's a listen.
The position of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, we are a 96-member strong caucus, has been for 3.5 months that we are not going to move one piece of the president's agenda without the much bigger piece of the president's agenda.
And we've heard basically the opposite from some moderate Democrats, this long game of you go first, no, you go first. What is the latest on which goes first and how they get sorted out, Ginger?
Well, Speaker Pelosi said this week that she was sort of going to try to separate these two so they stopped being considered something that had to happen in tandem. Although she may decide to do that, as Representative Jayapal was pointing out, she won't agree with that. I think this is a case, and it's important to remember, we're talking about bills that overwhelmingly all of the Democrats want, right? There isn't really a Democrat that we expect to say no to any of these pieces of legislation at the end of the day. So they're sort of arguing about process a bit, and they're trying to keep their leverage. That's really what's happening here with Jayapal. They want to get as much as they possibly can out of that social safety net bill. And they think that if they pass the infrastructure bill, they're going to lose all their leverage. The problem is that their leverage is that they would delay something that they've pretty much admitted ultimately they're going to pass anyway. And if you're Joe Manchin, the person you're trying to pressure in this system, in this idea, he doesn't really mind that much if they pass the infrastructure bill today or next week or next month. He thinks it's going to get done. So it might not be as much pressure as they were hoping, but it sure has made for some fun drama in Washington for those of us who watch it. Lots of speculation that things could die. And I think really the big question we have is the social safety net bill, when it does pass, since it's likely to ultimately pass, is it $1 trillion or is it $3.5 trillion? And those are very different bills that would include very different programs.
What are some of the things in the bigger program that might be taken off the table in this sort of back and forth negotiation process?
I mean, one of the first things we've seen that looks like it is going to have a hard time remaining in the package is something that's actually been proposed now by the last two presidents, which is letting the government negotiate drug prices for Medicare recipients. This is something that Trump and now Biden have argued will help save the federal government money and provide better health coverage because they'll get a better price for prescription drugs, mainly for seniors. Pharma and some other outside groups are fighting this, and they're telling seniors that ultimately it's going to make it so the government can tell them they can't have certain medications, that it's going to allow them to not cover some. And for that reason, there's an increasing amount of lawmakers who are saying that they won't support including that provision in that social safety net bill.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from NBC News Digital, looking at some of the top stories in the nation's capital. You can join in with your thoughts on infrastructure, what you want to see pass, not see pass. If you want to see that Medicare drug, prescription drug negotiation thing stay in the package, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts or questions about a possible government shutdown, the debt ceiling coming up, or questions about that, 800-642-1234 is the number. Ginger, you said you also expect to see the government get funded and not shut down by the end of the week. What is the latest on that, though?
Yeah, we think that the Senate could vote as early as this afternoon on what they're calling a clean continuing resolution. That means it's a bill that just funds the government, and the one that they're discussing would be through December 3rd, and it doesn't include a separate provision to raise the debt ceiling. This was the provision that came under attack from Republicans and was the reason that they voted down the first attempt to fund the government on Monday. Seems Democrats are saying, fine, you know, you don't want to do it, then don't, but we got to fund the government. We can't have a shutdown on Friday, and that they're going to proceed with this funding bill. So we expect that within the next 36 hours, we'll see both chambers sort of quickly pass this funding bill and ensure that Friday morning, the federal government is still open and operating.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. EJ is with us in Oshkosh. EJ, hello.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It's DJ.
Oh, DJ, I'm sorry.
But no worries. Listen, I respect you all very much, but I've grown up with this my whole life. It's really just a bunch of political posturing, and it's a game of chicken. These career politicians and the sociological sycophants, they just need to let this run its course once and for all and let it go if that's the way that it's going to be. It's the Dutch boy, the paint boy, sticking all their fingers in a dike that isn't going to hold, and all this political posturing. Just let it run its course.
And run its course by let it go, you mean allow a shutdown, DJ?
I'm all for it. We've been bolstering this false system for too long.
All right, I got you, DJ. Thanks for the call. Ginger says, DJ says, let it go. Let's put an end to this game of chicken and just let a shutdown happen. We did let that happen some years back, at least a partial shutdown. Is there a lot of stomach for that in Washington right now?
Absolutely not. I think that it's highly, highly unlikely that we see a government shutdown. I mean, Republicans aren't asking for anything. They're not putting demands on funding, saying that they won't fund the government unless they get something else, which is what we saw happen in 2013 when they wanted the Affordable Care Act repealed. And I think this really goes to sort of a fundamental difference between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats are willing to back off their demands, the debt ceiling demands, because they think government needs to be open and that it's important. Republicans weren't willing before to back off their demands because they're okay with the government being shut down for some period of time. Democrats do not see that as an acceptable path, especially in a pandemic when the CDC and the FDA and so many government agencies are still being utilized so heavily that I would be shocked if the government is not open on Friday. I think that they really view this as a top priority to make sure that that happens.
Thanks for the call, DJ. We're talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, with us today for our roundup of some of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. coming up a little more on a possible government shutdown and that debt ceiling and the possible U.S. Government default, the politics of that and the meaning of it if it happened. You can join in on those topics at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Ginger Gibson stays with us from NBC News Digital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the impact of an not super likely, but still possible government shutdown starting as soon as this weekend? Are you worried about the U.S. debt ceiling? If it's not increased, possible defaults on debt payments, big impacts on the economy. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. I want to turn to that debt ceiling now, Ginger. And Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas here talking about Democrats' efforts to raise the debt ceiling in a press conference. Here's a listen to him talking yesterday.
They currently are scrambling to try to figure out how are they going to lift the debt ceiling, something that's Leader McConnell told them they would have to do. If they're determined to spend at least $3.5 trillion more in borrowed money, that they were going to have to lift the debt ceiling to accommodate that debt by themselves.
Senator Cornyn there speaking today. I said yesterday. It was actually earlier today. Ginger, the debt ceiling, first of all, what happens? It sounds abstract. What happens if we don't raise the debt ceiling and can't keep paying off debts we've already incurred?
So this is all an estimate of what would happen since the U.S. government has never defaulted on its debt before. But in theory, if the U.S. did default on its debt, we would see the markets likely go berserk because we use U.S. Treasury bonds to back so much of the stock market. It would have reverberating effects throughout the markets, which then in turn would have reverberating effects throughout the government, I mean, the economy. And one would have to assume that if we did so, it would be harder for us to borrow in the future, which would mean that where we get fairly cheap money now, because we're the U.S. government and everyone assumes we're good for it when we say that we will pay them back. If we didn't pay someone back at some point, other entities might be less inclined to loan our government money and it may become more expensive. So even the simple things that we borrow for now could become a lot more costly for the American taxpayer to do in the future.
And that statement that Democrats would spend $3.5 trillion more in borrowed money, the $3.5 trillion in the Democrats' spending plan isn't entirely or all borrowed, right? There are some pay-fors along the way. Do I have that right?
That's right. So just so that everyone is, if they haven't heard this before, I'll say it again. Raising the debt ceiling by October is not to pay for any bill that the Democrats are currently trying to pass. It's to pay for things that Congress has already approved spending money on, things that President Trump signed and approved. And so this is old spending that they're borrowing money for. And then, yes, you're right. This $3.5 trillion would not all be borrowed money. Some of it would be paid for. It includes raising taxes to pay for it. It includes cutting programs elsewhere. It also includes some budget tricks that have allowed the White House and Democrats in Congress to try to contend that it doesn't cost anything. That's a bit of a stretch. We do know that it does cost things and that it likely would incur some debt in the future, but not the raise that they're being asked to do now.
What are we hearing in general from Republicans? It seems like Republicans in the Senate want the debt ceiling to be increased. They don't want the government to default, but they're not looking to vote for it. They want it to be on Democrats. Is that right?
I mean, this is pure politics at its very base. They think the debt ceiling should be increased. They think that it would be catastrophic if we didn't increase the debt ceiling by next month. But they think that it is a perfect talking point for them and next year's elections to say, Democrats raised the debt ceiling by X number of dollars. And for that reason, they don't want to take a vote that raises it. They want to make Democrats do it all on their own so that they can have that talking point. And it's really just brass tacks politics that we're watching play out.
So Democrats can't pass it on their own in normal ways because Republicans can and have blocked votes on it and blocked it from going from a filibusterable thing to a majority vote. So what can Democrats do if they want to pass the debt ceiling without Republican support?
So they could. We talked earlier about the social safety net bill. It's one that's using sort of a sleight of hand, a rules trick to get through without any Republican support. They could do it with that, or they could put it on another bill. And what it was being discussed right now, and what I wouldn't rule out as an option, you know, they find some piece of legislation that's already cleared the filibuster that names a post office, and they attach a debt ceiling increase to it. And then Republicans simply don't object. And require that the bill receive another 60 votes and then have it voted on by 50 Democrats. That's one option for them, and something that has been done in the past and could be done again if Democrats decide to give up on their goal to make Republicans also take this difficult vote and just go ahead and do it themselves.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, looking at some of the top stories this week in the nation's capital. Want to switch gears now, Ginger. We heard from General Mark Milley and other military leaders about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, about the withdrawal itself, some revelations from books by Robert Woodward and Robert Costa with comments from General Milley in them. What kind of things do we hear, first of all, looking at the withdrawal from Afghanistan from these military leaders?
Yeah, we heard testimony in the Senate yesterday from some of these leaders, including Milley, as you said, McKenzie, Secretary Austin. And there was the suggestion that, contrary to what President Biden was saying at the time, his military advisors were telling him to leave a small number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan beyond that August 31st withdrawal date. Now, Secretary Austin did point out that had they left troops there, the Taliban would no longer recognize the ceasefire, and they would have started firing on U.S. troops at the beginning of September. And that would have been a very difficult situation and might have cost us more American lives. But we did learn that they had recommended some troops stay on the ground in Afghanistan. And we also learned about some of the challenges that they were facing as they watched the Afghanistan government collapse.
What did they say about that? And again, and this was what I think few people anticipated, not that the Taliban would end up in control of Afghanistan, but that it would happen so quickly as the U.S. was in the midst of this huge logistical effort to withdraw Americans and many Afghans from the country. What kind of things did they say about that timeline that caught them off guard?
Yeah, you know, the U.S. government seems to have come to terms some number of years ago with the fact that the Taliban were going to regain control of Afghanistan, that short of just indefinite occupation by the U.S., that was going to happen. But we heard Secretary Austin say yesterday that he was surprised. They were caught entirely off guard by how quickly it happened, that the U.S. thought they would, while they had some presence there, because they were still there on the ground, that they would be able to help bolster the Afghan security forces and keep the Taliban at bay. But it became apparent rapidly that even with them there as they were exiting, they were unwilling to fight, and that they were abandoning their posts and allowing the Taliban to take over. And that really caught a lot of Americans, military and intelligence officials, off guard.
Milley also got questions about calls he made to a counterpart in China, revealed in that book I mentioned, Peril. What kind of things did lawmakers want to find out from him?
Yeah, we heard Milley on Tuesday sort of try to preemptively answer some questions about this. He said that these calls were done at the direction of the defense secretaries at the time, members of the Trump administration, and that they were done in accordance with regular communications, that it was his obligation to tell the Chinese that they had no intention of bombing them, and that he was acting based on the intelligence. Now, when he got into testimony on Wednesday in the House, it went a little different. We saw House members who often are a little bit more extravagant. And then we saw Representative Cheney really sort of criticizing fellow Republicans for what they were saying to Milley about his role in that phone call, and a little bit more of an inner party clash in that case. But Milley has been consistent that he did nothing wrong, and that he was obligated to tell the Chinese when the U.S. learned that the Chinese thought the U.S. was going to attack them, that that was not actually something that was in the works.
And in that Peril book, at least in the early releases, when this information was first coming out, it was unclear whether General Milley was lone wolfing this, reaching out to China on his own initiative versus doing, as he said, this under the direction of the Secretaries of Defense as part of the chain of command. There's been other reporting on this suggesting it was the latter. Is this the last word on this, do you think?
Yes, I think that that's what Milley was saying. He was doing this because the Secretary of Defense had asked him to. And I think it's important to remember here that, as he pointed out, Trump didn't intend to attack the Chinese. So it wasn't like he was promising them that he would tell them ahead of an expected attack, right? There was no attack in the works. And that lines of communication like this between world military leaders are common and important and are done to keep people from thinking attacks are coming that aren't. And that that's what he was doing. He was simply making sure no one had a was misinformed and that they were going to start doing things expecting the U.S. To fire missiles at them.
In our last minute, Ginger, what story is at top of mind for you over the next week or two?
I think we're going to be watching how House Democrats interact with one another. If you're a lover of politics, this is a moment for their party to figure out where they stand and what they're doing. And I would be paying a little attention to how they get along. I think Nancy Pelosi will go down in history as one of the most effective speakers to ever run the House chamber. And this is going to be a big moment for her as she tries to deliver President Biden a big legislative victory. Looks like we're in crunch time. So this is it, I think, in the next week or so.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. She was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the first episode of the new WPR podcast, Mapped Out, telling the story of legislative redistricting in Wisconsin, looking at how the process works, how gerrymandering happens, and focusing in on what happened 10 years ago and what it's meant for Wisconsin politics and policy ever since then. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, find out how a Catholic diocese in western Wisconsin is working to help Afghan refugees who are applying for special immigration visas. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the boundaries of Wisconsin's congressional and legislative districts are the subject of two active lawsuits, and they'll need to be redrawn ahead of elections in the state next spring. Yesterday on Central Time, we talked about those legal challenges and how the practice of gerrymandering has impacted our politics. That's also the subject of the new documentary podcast from WPR Reports, Mapped Out, which debuts today. It digs into the history of Wisconsin's current electoral maps, how they were drawn 10 years ago, and what it's meant for state government in the decades since. Each week for the next month, you can hear new episodes every Wednesday here on Central Time and Thursdays at 7 on The Morning Show. In the first episode, WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson explain the complex process of redistricting and why it matters.
There are these terms in politics that you hear all the time. Red state, blue state, purple state.
Purple state. It's what happens when you mix the same amount of red and blue. And Wisconsin is just about as purple as they come.
Because elections here, well, the statewide elections, are about as close as they get.
Take the 2020 presidential election. Almost 3.3 million people voted here, a record number. And President Joe Biden won by less than 1%.
Spread the faith. God love you all. May God bless America and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Less than 1%, just 21,000 people. You could fit almost four times that many people in Lambeau Field.
And the 2016 presidential race was just as close, but it went the other way. Former President Donald Trump won Wisconsin that year.
Together, we will make America great again.
His margin was about the same, around 23,000 votes, less than 1%.
In Wisconsin, sometimes Democrats win. Sometimes it's Republicans. The political pendulum swings back and forth.
And it's not just races for president, like in 2018.
In case you may have forgotten, I'm Tony Evers, and I'm incredibly proud to be the 46th governor of the great state of Wisconsin.
Democrat Tony Evers beat former Republican Governor Scott Walker.
But just 4 years before that, it was Walker who came out on top.
Thank you for coming out. God bless you. Thanks for your support. And let's move on to four more great years.
What's another sign you might be a purple state? Your elected officials can sometimes be on extreme ends of the political spectrum.
Look at our U.S. senators. They're kind of a political odd couple. You have Republican Ron Johnson, one of former President Trump's biggest supporters.
And you have Democrat Tammy Baldwin, who tried to impeach Trump twice.
But there's something that doesn't fit here. In this purple state where both parties win and power swings back and forth,
our state legislature, it's red.
It's very red, and it has been for the past decade. The pendulum never swings. But why?
A big reason? Redistricting.
In this podcast, we'll tell you how the political map Republicans drew a decade ago has helped lock in their power.
How the state's district lines were drawn in secret, with even legislators left in the dark.
How the battle over the maps went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And how redistricting is happening again, right now. From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out. You can't tell the story of political power in Wisconsin without redistricting. The two are inextricably linked.
It's an unseen force. Invisible lines on a map that have real, tangible effects on people's lives. It cemented fundamental changes in Wisconsin. The gutting of unions, changes to voting laws, tax cuts for business.
But despite all this, redistricting remains something of a mystery to many people.
So what do you guys know about redistricting?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
I'm just stupid saying that, but nothing.
You might in the city of Milwaukee or for the state.
We asked a bunch of people, not legislators or lawyers, just people. What do you know about redistricting? And for some people, it's not a lot.
Absolutely nothing. I really don't know.
I would say I'm probably supposed to be worried about it, but I don't pay attention enough to politics to really know anything about it. So, yeah.
I mean, sure, I wish I knew more. I'm not going to lie, I wish I knew more about politics, period. But I'm also going to go about my day here happy.
This is really common. People say it's not that they're not interested in redistricting. They just don't know about it. They never learned about it in school.
Do you ever remember learning about redistricting in college, high school, middle school?
I don't. I really don't. Not so much. I feel like I should know that, and that's a miss, and makes me feel uninformed. But I don't, maybe I'm a little. But
we know that this is how a lot of people feel. Frankly, neither of us remembered learning about this in school.
But it's worth learning about now because redistricting is hugely important. You can't talk about political power without talking about redistricting.
Still, it's complicated. There's no doubt about it. So before we get too into the weeds, we have to cover the basics. We need to go back to school, and we're going to need a teacher.
So what got you interested in teaching civics and government in person?
Because it's fascinating. I've been a political junkie forever.
That's David Olson. He's a high school government teacher. and he is into this stuff.
David, Mr. Olson, taught social studies at Madison Memorial High School for 10 years. And at least from what we can tell, his classes were fun.
If you were in Mr. Olson's class, you might have worked on a mock political campaign that was a lot like a real campaign. Platforms, media strategy, attack ads, debates. And in deeply democratic Madison, he made a point of bringing in political operatives from both parties to judge his students' campaigns.
They need to know that there are many other political positions out there.
Not every Wisconsin high school student has to learn about redistricting. In fact, some school districts don't require any kind of government class at all. But in Mr. Olson's class, you did.
So students need to learn about redistricting because it has definite consequences for who represents them and what policies we create.
So with Mr. Olson's help, we're going to take you through it.
Ready?
Class is in session.
Everything we are going to talk about in this lesson and this podcast would not be possible without an event that happens once every 10 years.
And man, it is an event. Actually, you should take out your pocket constitutions right now because you all have them because I gave them to you. This is a constitutionally mandated exercise that we must enumerate our citizens. What do we call that term when we count everybody up?
It's called the U.S. Census.
So the census, this process where we count everyone, happens every decade. Why? Because the U.S. Constitution says we have to. And not to get too dramatic here, but the census is as old as American democracy itself.
And it just happened again. The census counted people last year.
So we count people, we find out where they live, and we use that information to draw maps, to do redistricting.
Redistricting. So think of it this way. Wisconsin has 8 U.S. House seats, and each seat, each member of the U.S. House, represents a district.
Those districts are like 8 puzzle pieces that cover the map of Wisconsin. Redistricting decides what those puzzle pieces will look like for the next decade.
And this happens in every single state that has more than one member of the House. It also happens in every single state for the purposes of their state legislature.
Did you catch that? Redistricting not only decides what those 8 congressional puzzle pieces are going to look like, it also slices up Wisconsin into 99 state assembly districts and 33 state senate districts.
Each of those districts, those puzzle pieces, is represented at the state capitol by people. Your state representatives and your state senators.
And when we talk about the full puzzle, the way those pieces fit together, we are talking about a map, a political map.
Every 10 years, the Wisconsin Constitution requires that that map be redrawn. The puzzle pieces change because the population changes.
Okay, so think about the community where you live, okay? Have there been people moving out? Have there been new apartment buildings going up? Right? Did your city get bigger or smaller in your lifetime? Right? Because that's going to make a difference as to how big your district is.
So when David, Mr. Olson, talks about how big your district is, he's talking about the geographic size of the district on the map, the size of the puzzle piece.
He's not talking about the number of people, because each district has to be roughly equal in population.
This is a fundamental part of redistricting. One person, one vote. We do the census and then we divide everyone up so that every district has about the same number of people.
Now, any summary of redistricting that you read will tell you that the whole system is also based on these things called traditional redistricting principles. And they are
compactness,
contiguity,
preservation of communities of interest,
and preservation of the unity of political subdivisions.
Catchy, right?
They're kind of like rules, but really more like suggestions, because they're not actually required under the U.S. Constitution. And exactly what they mean is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Take compactness, for example. Sounds like a good rule, right? You don't want a district to be too spread out. But what is too spread out?
The U.S. Supreme Court uses what they call an eyeball approach. No, seriously. They say you just look at it.
Contiguity is more straightforward. A district needs to be one piece.
You can't take a chunk of Madison and group it with a chunk of Green Bay and then add Superior and call it a district. That's against the rules.
But what about the next traditional redistricting principle? Communities of interest. Good luck defining that one. The idea is that you're supposed to keep people with common interests together.
What kind of interests? Pretty much anything. Maybe it's people who send their kids to a certain school, or everyone north of a certain highway. Let's just say, if this one's on the test, it'll be an essay question.
Now, about that other principle, preservation of the unity of political subdivisions. This one probably sounds the most complicated, but it's actually pretty easy to understand.
Districts are supposed to respect local boundary lines, county lines, cities, villages, that kind of stuff.
The thing is, mapmakers break this rule all the time. Sometimes it's just out of necessity, but sometimes it's a choice.
Mapmakers make a lot of choices. That's their job. But sometimes those choices, the way they divvy up the puzzle pieces, can go a long way to deciding who holds power and who doesn't.
How do they do it? Gerrymandering. More on that after the break.
We're listening to the first episode of Mapped Out, the new podcast from WPR Reports about the issue of redistricting in Wisconsin and how our current electoral maps came to be. Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden this week are taking a close look at how redistricting works and how it can be used for partisan advantage. We'll hear more coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening to the first episode of the new WPR podcast series, Mapped Out, which digs into the history of the state's current electoral maps and the impact they've had. This week, Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson explain how redistricting works and how that process can be used for partisan advantage, also known as gerrymandering.
All right, class, all right. Take your seats, take your seats. So we've talked about the census. We've talked about redistricting. Now we need to talk about how politicians can use the process to their advantage. We're talking about gerrymandering.
At the beginning of this episode, we said that a lot of people we talked to had never even heard of redistricting.
But gerrymandering? That sounds more familiar.
Does the word gerrymandering bring anything to mind for either of you? Gerrymandering?
I think that's when you kind of stack the deck and you get votes, you get voters, they redistrict and they get the voters in there to change the way the district ends up voting.
I heard that. I should pay more attention to stuff. But I heard the term, but I'm like, oh, they're pissed. Because we watch it on the news and I'm like, oh, that guy's pissed. You know? Yeah, there's really some strong feelings on both sides, you know?
Is redistricting something that you're familiar with?
No.
Have you heard a term that sometimes gets thrown around is gerrymandering? Is that a term that you're familiar with?
I've seen it on little signs on the side of the road. That's about it.
What do the signs say?
It's like stop. Gerrymandering, whatever. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of being sleazy and do things that, you know, just aren't good. I mean, it just to serve their own purpose.
Yeah, when politicians will use redistricting to their advantage.
Gerrymandering is not just another name for redistricting. David Olson, Mr. Olson, says it's a type of redistricting.
Gerrymandering is this process of drawing political lines, of drawing district lines for a political or partisan advantage.
Okay, so this is the part of the lesson where we're obligated to tell you that the term gerrymandering comes from a state senate district drawn like 200 years ago in Massachusetts. A guy named Elbridge Gerry was governor. And yeah, it's Gerry, not Jerry. Go figure.
The district looked kind of funny. A political cartoon said it looked like a salamander.
Which I think, and my students think, looks way more like a dragon than a salamander. I'd have never seen a salamander with wings.
So Elbridge Gerry plus salamander equals gerrymander. Get it? Okay, there is a point to this.
This used to be the only way people thought about gerrymandering. Funny-shaped districts. And that can be a sign of a gerrymander.
But it's not the shape of the district that matters so much as the outcome it creates. Because practically speaking, how a district gets drawn can decide who gets a voice in politics and who doesn't.
And when you draw the maps to silence the voice of one party, that is partisan gerrymandering.
Here's the thing. Partisan gerrymandering is not illegal under federal law, and mapmakers do it all the time.
And when we talk about mapmakers, we're not talking about cartographers exactly. We're talking about the people who are in charge of the process, the people with the power.
And you know what they say about power?
You know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. This is not a Democratic or Republican problem in and of itself. It's a both and, right? This is something where politicians who are empowered often take advantage to cement their own power, right? And ultimately, that undermines the power of individuals to have a say in their government.
Okay, got all that?
Yeah, the census happens, and then redistricting, which is drawing a map, which is a puzzle, which can be manipulated, and that's called gerrymandering, right?
Yeah, simple as that.
Cool.
Moving on. So, class. This would be a good time to mention how this works in Wisconsin. Who draws the maps?
In Wisconsin, the state constitution says it's the legislature, and whatever they come up with has to be approved by the governor, just like any other bill.
And they do it after the census. Like we said, this is a redistricting year right now.
So are they going to be able to do it?
Well, if you know anything about our legislature, which is run by Republicans, and our governor, Tony Evers, who is a Democrat, you know they fight a lot.
And that's putting it lightly. They could, in theory, agree on a redistricting plan, but this is extremely unlikely, which means the next map could be decided in court.
This has basically been the norm in Wisconsin for more than 50 years, because for most of that time, Wisconsin has been under divided government. The state Senate, Assembly, and Governor's Office were not controlled by the same party at the same time. This is pretty normal in a purple state.
But the last time Wisconsin's maps were drawn, things were different. It was 2011.
As your governor, I make this pledge. Wisconsin is open for business.
Scott Walker was governor, and the GOP controlled both houses of the legislature. Republicans had just won a massive wave election.
That gave them total control over the redistricting process. They got to draw the map they wanted.
So we know class is almost over, but before you pack up your backpacks, there's one more lesson. Redistricting has consequences, real consequences that affect your life. Mr. Olson says, whether you like it or not, one of those consequences is clear.
The consequence of Republicans doing a really good job of getting elected in 2010 was they made it easier for themselves to get elected in 2012 and 2014 and on and on and on.
How did this happen? How did one election change Wisconsin for a decade and possibly years to come?
That's next week on Mapped Out.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky, music by Carl Christensen, additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major, artwork by John Nichols. Special thanks to Brady Carlson, Jay Carlisle Larson, and Peter Bryant.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
Next week on Mapped Out, we'll hear how Wisconsin's redistricting plan came together 10 years ago during a chaotic and consequential time at the state capitol. You can hear new episodes of Mapped Out each Wednesday at 3:30 here on Central Time and on Thursdays after 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the economic divide in the U.S. may be even more divided than in the past. Find out why we're less likely to know people from different backgrounds and why it could be bad for all of us. How should we teach civics and history? State lawmakers are tackling those questions. A Wisconsin historian joins the show, and you can too. Plus, a look at the challenges facing veterinarians during the pandemic. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Today is National Coffee Day for some reason. Some coffee shops celebrated with free or cheap coffee offers. I celebrated by drinking exactly as much coffee as I drank yesterday. I'll continue to celebrate tomorrow by drinking the same amount of coffee again. Dean Knetter mixed things up in his coffee consumption a while back. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
Now, you're a half and half guy, generally, like me, right?
Yeah, normally just a little splash of half and half is good enough for me. But a couple months back, I was making coffee and realized that I was pouring heavy whipping cream into my cup. And then it struck me that I've been doing this for a long time. At some point during the past year, I switched over to heavy whipping cream and kept buying it and kept using it for reasons unbeknownst to me. This is not a choice I made. It just kind of happened and stuck. So after getting over the shock, I dialed it back to the half and half.
I'm trying to get my head around this, Dean. Like, did you initially accidentally buy it, or did you have heavy whipping cream around for, you know, a dessert project?
I have been doing some baking over the last year too, so I must have had it around for a dessert, grabbed for it, and said, hey, this is some luxuriant coffee. I'm going to stick with this subconsciously, I guess.
Okay, I get that, and you want to finish it off, but you're at the grocery store to buy the half and half again, and you accidentally keep buying heavy whipping cream?
Hey, that's a mystery to me. I'm just glad I figured it out now.
I'm not sure if I buy it. All right, this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.